What's your pick this week, Sean?
You said what's your pick this week?
Ah!
Ah, rats. Got you.
Damn it! We should keep track of these things. Welcome to Season 1, Episode 7 of the Swift Over Coffee podcast. I'm Paul Hudson.
And I'm Sean Allen.
So Sean, as a USian, you have just celebrated Thanksgiving. Did you go back to your family or did you make them all fly out to the West Coast?
I wish I could have made them all fly out to the West Coast, but no, I made the trip back east. I'm currently in Charlotte, North Carolina for Thanksgiving at my sister's house, and then driving back up to Pennsylvania here in a couple days for Christmas. I'm actually lucky. I get to work remotely for this entire holiday season, thanks to my job. So very thankful for that. But yeah, it's been a fun trip so far. How about you? Did you go anywhere?
No, it's Thanksgiving is a US holiday, so it's just a general day over here, sadly. I went to a safari park today with the kids, but it's just a generic day over here.
Just another day. All right, Paul, let's talk about some news. And the first thing we have up is Swift 5's final branching. So this happened on November 16th, and this essentially means Swift 5 is done. Of course, there's bug fixing and testing, and only a few select changes will get in. But, for all intents and purposes, we're done with Swift 5. And presumably any new changes will go into Swift 5.1, depending on if they go with that number system, most likely. But it looks like we're on track for that, super narrow release date of early 2019.
Which is the last day of the last month of whatever you can consider early, I think.
right.
To be fair, it's taken a long time to get to this point. After Swift 4.2, I kind of assumed that 5 would be all about ABI stability. And don't get me wrong, that's really important, but I'm glad to see other great features made the cut too. A particular favorite for me is raw strings, I've mentioned before, but there's compact map values on dictionary, there's count where on sequences, is multiple of for integers. These are all nice additions to the language.
And speaking of language features, let's talk about something that didn't make it into Swift 5. And this is a follow-up from a previous episode where we talked about optional iteration. Now, to kind of recap this, optional iteration would have created a convenience pattern to handle optional iteration. The proposal suggested we use for question mark in our for loop. So instead of, for item in array, it would have been for question mark item in array. And it would have behaved very similar to optional chaining and save the extra step of using, if let or guard let to unwrap that array.
This was a proposal I really wanted to see pass. Although, like I said in the previous episode, the precise syntax it chose wasn't my favorite. I think it's okay that things get turned down now and then. That just shows a process is working correctly.
Yeah, but even though it got rejected, through that review discussion, the core team agrees that this is a problem worth solving. It is common enough that, we want to solve this problem. So many alternatives were discussed, but ultimately the core team strongly favors the idea of extending optional chaining to include for loops. So now the for loop would read for item in array question mark. The core team has requested a revised proposal with this new implementation to go through review again. So it's not certain, but looking like we could potentially see, something similar to this in Swift 5.1. We'll have to keep an eye out.
I don't actually know what the plans are for Swift after 5.0. The Swift team haven't announced anything yet, quite frankly. They've been doing so much work on ABI stability that I kind of wonder whether we'll see some sort of unleashing of potential, opening of the floodgates. Features they've been working on for a year or more will finally get looked at. Things like async await, for example, top of my list.
Yeah, I didn't even think about that until you just mentioned it. That is going to be very interesting because, like you said, ABI stability has been a priority for a very, very long time. And I'm sure a lot of stuff has been put on the back burner. So I do hope the floodgates open up. I'm excited for that. Moving on to another follow-up from last episode, Paul's pick was using URL protocol to mock your unit tests. And we got a Twitter response from Antoine Vanderlee, who says that's what he uses at WeTransfer.
Yeah, so Antoine's implementation is actually really nice. And it's much more advanced than what I ended up using in my own code. My own solution was just to add a dictionary of URLs and data instances so you can connect as many endpoints as you want. We'll include a URL to his GitHub repo in the show notes. So I think it's great to dive in and read someone else's source code, see how they've solved the same problem.
Yeah, definitely check that out. And to round up the news section, we're going to talk about some community news. First up, we had a ton of Black Friday sales over this U.S. holiday Thanksgiving break, where a lot of Swift books and courses were on sale. And we are releasing this podcast on a Monday, so you still might have a chance to get a few of those.
Yeah, so most of my own books are still on sale for the next couple of days as you record this. But you'll have to be fast if you're listening to this. I think it ends Wednesday after Cyber Monday. I also wrote an article about some of the other great books on sale. And in particular, I think folks should really check out Ben Sherman's offer from NS Screencast. His offer is amazing. It's half price for the life of your subscription. As long as you stay subscribed, you're half price. Incredible deal.
So in perpetuity, potentially, if you're always subscribed.
Yeah.
That's a great deal. So finally, Paul, we have some exciting announcements to make. We'd like to announce the results of the Swift Community Award. So take it away, Paul.
Yeah, so by the time this is released, I'll hopefully have published the full results on the site. But I can give you the highlights. The winner of the best conference category was Try Swift. You know, Natasha's done amazing work there in New York and Tokyo. I think the Tokyo one had something like 700 attendees, which is very, very large for a Swift conference. In the best podcast category, the winner is Swift by Sundell.
I actually love John's podcast, mainly because, again, I was on it. So that's why that's always going to win brownie points for me. But no, just kidding. I do like it because anytime he has a guest on, he talks about that guest's area of expertise, if you will. So I think his most recent episode was about testing. My episode was all about content creation, teaching, and sharing. And so I like that it's a very focused episode based on the guest's expertise.
And in the best enterprise SDK category, we had Firebase. Obviously, they are now almost a standard in our environment. You know, Firebase or Realm, for example, are extraordinarily popular. But best open source project, bit of an upset here. Vapor won that category.
Yeah, it's funny you said a bit of an upset because I was kind of thinking the same thing. So at least with server-side Swift, when I do dive into it, I haven't really taken a deep dive yet, but I was going to default to Kitura. But now that I've seen Vapor win this, you know, award, now I'm going to have to look at both now because apparently a lot of people are Vapor fans out there.
It is hugely popular. And finally, the most inspiring presentation goes to Joachim Kurtz with his talk, MVC is Not Your Problem. I think it was delivered at UIConf this year. I've heard Joachim speak in person at iOS Dev UK this year, and he's very, very funny. He's very entertaining, but he also delivers, you know, meaningful educational material at the same time. So it's one thing being entertaining, another thing being educating at the same time. It's very, very hard to do.
As always, it's time for our picks. Paul, what do you got for us this episode?
So my pick this time is another great feature from Swift 5. It's SE0216 Dynamic Callable. So Swift 4.2 added dynamic member lookup, which lets us read from properties that don't exist on a type. So Swift looks them up at runtime by running a specific method. Now that might sound dangerous, but there are all sorts of type safety guarantees to make sure the code is still safe.
And so Dynamic Callable is going to build on this a little bit?
It's certainly complementary, right? It lets us run arbitrary methods on an object. It's not massively powerful just yet, because right now you kind of transform a struct or a class into a function. So rather than saying my object dot my method and passing in some parameters, you call my object directly as if it were a function.
But the method doesn't exist, so what happens?
So you add a method to your type with a very specific name, dynamically call. That's the name of the method. And this gets run when you call the function. And it's your chance to decide what should happen. You'll be given an array of the parameters that are passed in, or if you want to use labels, then you'll get a dictionary of them to work with. And you then look through all the parameters and decide what should happen based on those labels. And as long as you return whatever value you said you would in the method signature, an int or a string or whatever you want to, then Swift's happy.
All right, Paul, I know I'm early in my career, but I'm just not seeing the use case for this. What, educate me. What's going on here?
Well, it won't surprise anyone to learn. This is just another proposal from Chris Lattner, who's been working really, really hard to make Swift interoperable with Python and Ruby and other languages.
So this helps, like, language works together. And we know, you know, Chris is over at Google with TensorFlow and, you know, Swift might be TensorFlow's language. So now I'm kind of seeing where this is going.
Yeah, so Python has lots of things we might want to use. In the case of Chris and Google, like you said, that mostly means machine learning libraries. You know, Python really rules the roost there, and there's no point in us rewriting all that code in Swift. So if Swift and Python can work together more easily, we get to draw on all of Python's machine learning functionality while still getting to write Swift for everything else.
But earlier you said it's not that powerful.
Well, ideally, we'd like to be able to write something like, you know, my object.myMethod or my object.myOtherMethod or whatever, to have the ability for different dynamic method calls to be run on an object. And that would make the whole thing significantly more flexible. You know, in particular, I can imagine having that for an instant mocking framework for testing, for example. It'd be really, really powerful. Anyway, enough about my pick. What's your pick, Sean?
So my pick is, I'd like to explore a topic that's been discussed, you know, very heavily in our community, almost to the point of exhaustion, but I still wanted to talk about it. And that was a play on words a little bit, exhaustion. And that is the topic of burnout. I stumbled across this article from Paul Johnston that focused on early stage startup culture and the negative effects, you know, on the mental health of developers. And I myself work in an early stage startup at the moment, so it resonated with me. But this article talks about how in this culture, developers typically need to get things built like as fast as they possibly can, you know, because they have short runways or maybe the company needs a feature in order to help, you know, raise the next round of funding. But he also talks about how we as developers are notoriously bad at estimating time it takes to build things and how this can lead to overworking to meet those deadlines that, you know, we may have mismanaged. And there's a meme going around Twitter lately. I'm sure many of you have seen it where it's like, you know, the product manager says, you know, how long will this take? And then it says, my brain, don't say it, don't say it, don't say it, don't say it, don't say it. And then you say, I should have that done by the end of the day. And yeah, I'm sure we've all said that before. I do that all the time.
There are all sorts of ways of trying to make estimates, but I'm pretty sure they all come down to guesswork. I mean, the best I've found in my own team environments is planning poker. But that's just like distributed guesswork in a group. That's all we're doing.
So I've actually never heard that term, planning poker. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah, so you can actually buy these cards, decks of dedicated cards. I bought two for myself and they're excellent. And you hand out cards to folks and they have numbers on that double up. So 1, 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, whatever, up to a point. And you then say, okay, how long will it take to make the widget red? And everyone draws one card from their thing, their pack of cards, and at the same time turns it around. And you kind of look at all the numbers. Oh, she thinks it's a 4, he thinks it's an 8, she thinks it's a 2, whatever. Between you, you know, you might discuss the outliers. You know, why do you think it's a 40, for example?
Right.
And that person can then justify their choice. But then you hopefully find some sort of middle ground. As a group, you think mostly it's an 8.
Yeah, that's interesting. I do see what you say about distributed guesswork, but I do think that's a little better than just having one person, you know, because they could have been that outlier, you know?
Yeah, finger in the wind, you know?
Right, right. So anyway, in the article, he goes on to discuss ways to prevent burnout. But the reason I wanted to discuss this is, you know, Paul and I are working in two very different environments. So I wanted to really talk to Paul about, you know, burnout in his environment versus burnout in my environment. Like I mentioned earlier, I am at a very early stage startup. We're still in the seed round. You know, Paul is self-employed, putting out an absurd amount of content and books and, you know, traveling the world speaking, which I hope to one day make the transition to self-employed content creator. And I know, shout out to Johnson Dell, who just recently made that transition. So congratulations. But yeah, I wanted to talk about burnout in that setting.
I'm fortunate enough that I've never really had burnout, apart from playing Burnout Paradise on my PlayStation.
Old school.
You know, that's a great game.
It is.
You know, I still get excited about working with new things, and my to-do list is very, very long. I think if I ever find something being a bit overwhelming, usually if I have lots of big, important tasks sort of stacking up around me, looming over me a little bit, I just kind of break them down to smaller tasks. Rather than doing one big thing, it's 10 small things and just dive in. Because for me, you know, one of the biggest motivators is having momentum. Do one thing, I feel built up to do another thing, and another thing, another thing, another thing, another thing.
Yeah, yeah, I agree with that momentum comment for sure. I have a quick question for you, because it was an assumption. I assume when you're building your own thing, working for yourself, because I have a little bit of it now with myself and the YouTube channel, do you find that easier to not get burnt out because you're building your own thing? You're not building just some app for another company.
Well, I certainly think there's no one else to blame.
No, yeah.
If my deadline is a bad deadline, it's too short, whatever, you know, if I've chosen the wrong opportunity to go for, it's my own fault. There's no one else to blame, which I think helps a lot. But at the same time, there's more of a worry around opportunity cost, I think. You know, mm-hmm. There's 10 things I can do. I choose one of them. based on my gut instinct, you know?
Right.
When you've got a team around you saying, hey, don't do that, do this or whatever, you've got other voices to hear chiming in. And there's much less of that when you're working by yourself, obviously.
Yeah, that's a good point. So a little bit about my situation is it's a little unique because, again, I am at an early stage startup where, again, typically developers have to build as fast as possible. But my startup has to deal with FDA approval, which is a very tedious process and takes 6 months to get approved, et cetera, et cetera. So I have this built-in time buffer. So my quality of life right now is great. But I have worked at startups where that wasn't the case. So I wanted to share some quick opinions, and I want to stress opinions, right? This can, you know, we can discuss this, so about burnout at the early stage startup. So I want you to keep in mind that when you're an early developer employee, not a founder, an employee, remember that you're building somebody else's, you know, product or company. You know, the founders are the ones who have all the upside. So unless you got, you know, founder level equity, there's no reason to overwork your, you know, and kill yourself for that company. You know, if you see the founders working super hard and, you know, burning the midnight oil, as they say, don't let that affect you too much. I've fallen into that trap feeling like I had to keep up with them and I had to work. But remember, they have all the upside. Your incentives, you know, don't quite line up.
Yeah, you remember that Red Dead Redemption article from a few weeks/months ago?
Yeah, but everybody was being overworked.
Yeah, the Hauser brothers are saying something like, you know, we don't overwork people, you know. But then there's a great comment saying something like, you know, someone will be saying, we're going to get dinner. We're going to get pizza. What do you want? And what they're really saying is, we're all working late. Are you in?
Right.
But they don't say that. They don't say you got to work late, work harder, work harder. They just say, hey, we're getting pizza. What do you want? So it's really quite a subtle way to sneak it in. And I had the same problem in my own work, even though I'm, you know, self-employed. I remember a couple of years ago, I was busy writing something, some book I expect. And my eldest daughter came in and said, do I want to play? And I said no, because I was busy working. But fortunately, it kind of had this immediate light bulb moment. Did I really just say that? Did I just say no, I don't want to play with my own kid? So I've tried to make it a policy that kids come before work, that family comes before work. So I don't say no to the play question that often anymore.
Which is quite nice. Right, right. No, it's great that you like realize that right away. It's like, whoa, wait, what? Did that word just come out of my mouth? Like, what?
No. That was me, you know?
Yeah, yeah. So, all right. So speaking of equity, another thing I want to point out is be careful not to be blinded by the possibility of an exit, you know, startup exit getting acquired or going public, and you making millions of dollars by being an early employee, right? That is the pipe dream we kind of all think about. But it's kind of that carrot on a stick, and that can lead to burnout, you know? Just keep in mind, startup exits are extremely, extremely rare. And even if they do have an exit, you have to stay at that company for, you know, 4 years for all your stock to vest, you know, which is an eternity.
I cannot imagine how weird it must be to stay at an average or even bad job just so your stock vests. I mean, I guess it's worth it.
I think it depends on the company. I don't know. I'm not calling Uber a bad job at all, but I've heard of a lot of Uber early employees are kind of in this position because Uber hasn't gone public, you know, and, you know, they've been there forever. I don't know.
I'm calling Uber a bad job.
All right, you said it, not me.
I think it's one of those things where, you know, if you have Uber on your resume, it's probably better to remove it and say, I was in prison for that time. That's better than saying I was at Uber for that time.
I think they're getting a little better now with the new CEO. I know what you're saying here. They did go through a rough patch, but I think they're turning around. At least I'm hopeful. Maybe I'm an optimist. But anyway, finally, the last thing about this is, you know, burning yourself out is very, very short-sighted. Like, think of your long-term career or your long-term, you know, time at that company. Like, sure, you could be incredibly productive and get a ton done working 12 hours a day for a few months, but that's just unsustainable. Like, you can't keep doing it. It's a tortoise in the hair kind of thing. So be happy with your job over the long run, and you'll just be much more productive over that time. But this is a hot topic, obviously, so we would love to hear your thoughts on the topic. You know, tweet us at Swift Over Coffee with your thoughts, and we'll continue the discussion on Twitter. Looking forward to it.
Okay, it's time for the open ballot. And this time, our question was, what is your favorite part of writing iOS apps with Swift? And it won't surprise anyone to learn we had a massive pile of answers here across a huge range of discussion. So I'll try and get through as many as we can, like usual. Let's just dive in straight away with some language features. The first one comes from Justin, who says, type safety makes me feel more confident that my apps won't crash unexpectedly at runtime because I've already had to think about nil cases. Javon Charles says, protocols. I love how you can use them to create complex types and how Swift already has so many of them that fulfill most needs. And Eric Crickler says, readability, except when people get cute and overuse shortcuts to shrink 30 characters of well-labeled code down to 6. which of course I totally never do. Do you do that? No.
Actually, I lean towards the 30 one. I'm a real stickler for readability. So I, if somebody ever puts a one letter variable in my code base, I might hit them.
Well, there's a great tweet recently full of coding guidelines written 30 years ago. And then one of them was keep your variable names short to make them compile and run faster, which right. may have made sense when you're working on like, you know, a ZX Spectrum or something hideous from the right. 80s.
Yeah.
But now it's like, let's move on slightly. I agree with John, though. Protocols are amazing things when used wisely. You know, I'm kind of against the idea of protocols first as a solution because I find they create unnecessary abstractions in your head. Mm-hmm. I'd rather have, you know, get your concrete types down first and then evolve from there to protocols as needed, rather than try and make generic reusable things you might actually need. Moving on, we had some answers about optionals. Besha Al-Maleh said, Swift was my first programming language, and I didn't like optionals at first. Now that I'm working on an Objective-C app, I miss many features in Swift I used to take for granted, including, that's right, optionals. And Anthony says he's also a big fan of type inference and optionals. Yes, he said optionals. And North of Normal said, I find guard statements to be weirdly poetic. Guard let is a trochee, the cadence of Poe and Longfellow. It's graceful and beautiful and reminds me that we can find and put poetry and truth with a capital T in our code. What do you think, Sean?
I love North of Normal's comment here. I did literally laughed out loud when I read this. I'm not big into poetry, but I thought it was just a great answer. And what Paul didn't read in parentheses, he said, I could go on at length about guard. So North of Normal, I would love to hear a guard poem. Like that'd be awesome to hear. But no, I'm a huge fan of guard statements as well. I look at them as like a line in the sand, you know, nothing gets executed under it. So I'm a big fan of guard as well.
So optionals like protocols are another feature I really love, but I advise folks to ditch as quickly as possible, and particularly optionals. You know, protocols, like I say, you can start with concrete types and expand to protocols. With optionals, I will always prefer having real types over optionals. Like a string question mark is a hole. It's a hole in my code. What should be in there? I don't know what should be in there. What does nil mean in this case? And Suresh Khan, who's got a great blog post, I think it's called That One Optional Property or something. And he talks about, you know, wrapping that in an enum instead. We can say case normal or case notification with a string message, or I'm having that being a nil optional type instead. So I prefer, you know, non-optionals where possible. Moving on, we have frameworks. David Ocken from IBM says, working with a camera. Every day I get to work with AV Foundation, I learn something new. It feels like an endless universe of an API. I should say David has a fantastic framework for doing machine learning called Lumina. He's done all the grunt work of hooking up machine learning to the camera. So you just say, launch me a Lumina view controller, please, and boom, it'll do all the recognition stuff for you. It's absolutely fantastic, that particular repo. We'll link it in the show notes. And Santos says, frameworks like ARKit, CoreML, and CreatorML make integrating augmented reality and machine learning into iOS apps so much easier and allows devs to focus on the uses of these technologies rather than the math behind it all. And for me, you know, frameworks are a fascinating thing because, you know, Swift's a very nice language. Objective-C, I still quite like. Got a lot of love for that language. But, you know, it's not objectively significantly better than other languages. You know, Objective-C was quite repetitive in the way it did some coding. But the frameworks, you know, when you touch UIKit, you're like, wow, this has some serious love behind it. You know, you look at core graphics or core image or core animation or all the cores or all the kits. They're just incredible. And of course, more recently, ARKit and CoreML and CreatorML, like you said, they're just brilliant, powerful things waiting to, you know, explode our fingertips. I love it.
Yeah, and just to echo what you said, because I mean, I don't have experience with, you know, Android or anything like that, so I can't compare the Apple frameworks to anything else, but man, they almost feel like cheating sometimes, right? They just can make things so easy, you know? It takes, you know, a few lines of code to get an ARKit scene up and running, and especially now with CreateML, you know, in the playgrounds, you can just, you know, do some machine learning in no time. So it almost feels like cheating a little bit, but I'm happy about it.
Moving on, Marco Pont says, the community and the readability of the language, and Stuart Lynch agrees, saying, without question, it is a supportive community. I have yet not to have one of my questions answered.
Yeah, I agree 1,000%. The community is amazing. Got tons of content creators putting out awesome stuff. Everybody is more than willing to be helpful and share their knowledge. So definitely want to echo that. Community is amazing.
It is. And don't get me wrong, we have improvements to make. We can get a lot better yet. But I think it's important that everyone works together to make it even better. You know, we're all in the same boat. We're all working towards the same goal of making great apps. You know, recently I tweeted about Black Friday sales. You know, here's the things I'm doing. But I pad in there, here's Ben Sherman from NS Screencast. Here's Obj.io. Here's Ray Wenderlich. I listed out all my, you know, co-authors effectively in the Swift community, because we're all working towards helping folks write better code and have more fun with Swift. It's not a zero-sum game. Draco Sveen says, coming from Visual Basic, Delphi, C++, C# and Python, Swift feels like Apple engineers took the best bits of all my favorite languages, put them together, added some sugar and spice, and came up with a language that 100% lives up to its name. And Periphery says, that feeling you get when you refactor a string-based API to use an enum. Now, personally, Sean, I haven't really got into this sort of enums for everything point of view just yet. I love enums. I love adding types to them and so forth, adding values to them. But I don't use them it's my first point of call yet, even though I know that's a really Swifty thing to do. Mm-hmm. What about you?
Yeah, I dabble in the enum game a little bit. Definitely don't enum all the things like people do. But yeah, I'm a fan, not going to lie. I also want to echo what Draco said about, you know, Apple engineers taking a little bit of each and every language. We kind of talked about this a couple episodes ago when talking about raw strings and how the Swift team basically used Rust implementation as a heavy inspiration. So I like the idea of, you know, taking what you like from all the best languages to create hopefully the ultimate language.
And also I should say that, you know, the language he listed, most of them anyway, have their own advantages. You know, I used Delphi, Object Pascal, for a number of years and really loved it. I wrote some great software in Delphi. You know, C#, I've had years of experience in C#. It's a great language, which is really driving forward the cutting edge of stuff. In fact, they have async await already. And they're just about to. Is it C# 7, C# 8? Just a new spec got announced. They're adding optionals into the language.
Oh.
So in some respects, you know, what Swift got from that language is now giving back to new versions of the new languages, so which is really cool to see.
Yeah.
And one last one to end on, Marcin Krzyżanowski said, it's too complex to be solved in a reasonable time.
So that's going to wrap up this episode of Swift Over Coffee. But as always, we want to leave you with the next open ballot question. And that is, what is an easy way for anyone to contribute to the Swift community? Now, this could be Swift, the language itself, or just any other part of the community.
Don't write books, though. I think we have enough of those.
Oh, agreed. And don't make videos either. Don't do YouTube. We have plenty of that. I'm just kidding. No, I actually encourage many people to make, you know, YouTube videos. I think it's awesome. I would love to see more channels personally.
Yeah, same for me in books. Go and write great Swift books. I'll buy them.
All right, that's going to do it for us. Tell your friends to subscribe and don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Swift Over Coffee, where we're going to continue the discussions we talked about today. See you next time.
Bye.